And now,
11LRNI.
Now the lights dim low, soon we'll start the show.
Here comes LF Network.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair. But her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a saddening bore, for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's the freakiest show. Take a look at the is their life on Mars? It's on America's tortured brow. Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame, 'cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hordes, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Rule Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog and clown. But the film is a saddening bore, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be writ again, as I ask you to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's a take a look at the lawman beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if he'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on
one of the absolute slowest fades on the planet. Welcome to the Midwood Files. My name is Ellis Midwood, and that was David Bowie, Life on Mars. Hi there. I got news and stuff, but it's been an interesting week for me personally. I don't get out much anymore since Jerry's not around. You know, she was prone to drag me out or make me go places in between going to doctor's visits. That was a payoff. You see, I had to go to a doctor's visit, and she'd drive me, but I'd have to go somewhere afterwards. So I don't get out as much. I just don't have as much human contact. Basically, it's me and the producer and the cats, and I talk to the cats like they're people. which is maybe a good thing, maybe a bad thing. And so I'm not, I just don't. So now, like, these, like, trips out to the doctor, you know, and I have more psych visits than I have regular doctor's visits, because I have that counseling every other week, and my shrink once a month, and they're in the same place. As a matter of fact, last trip I made, I was able to go to both without leaving the facility, which was actually kind of cool. They were like, kind of back to back. I can't always line it up that way, but it's less traveling, and I've given up on that state run shuffle service, whatever the heck it is, and I just Uber on over there now. It's, I don't know, like maybe 15, 20 bucks round trip. It's literally that close, and it's just, I don't have to stress it. I don't show up stressed. You know, when you're taking the shuttle thing and you're so stressed over, one, they're late, or two, they're actually on time, but you were stressing as to whether they were going to be late. I'm literally showing up in the office pre-stressed. And, you know, that's not the kind of thing I do. There's plenty of other things in my life to be stressed about. I don't think that, you know, I should be stressed in my transportation. So I've decided to take the Uber thing, and Uber's working out really well. So I had an appointment on Wednesday. I had one of those back-to-back appointments on Wednesdays, and I hadn't had a chance to see my my shrink because she had COVID. She got COVID. And it's pretty funny. I have a pretty good relationship with her. And we were talking about it, and she says, you know, because she knows I don't really leave the house too much. Even when I had my built-in chauffeur, I didn't really leave the house too much. And she goes, you know, she says to me, I was thinking about what you were saying, you know, in regards to, like, pretty much you just come here and you go home, and you come here and you go home. And that being the case, for the most part, you're less likely to encounter people who might make you sick. Now, I kind of countered that with the fact that, you know, it is a doctor's office and there are regular doctors downstairs. More than a few times I've gotten sick, like a cold or something, after coming in to the office. So, you know, that should really make you feel good in regards to the COVID stuff, right? So, you know, and I'm concerned now, you know, being fully vaccinated, apparently I'm super vulnerable. And so was she, by the way. She was totally vaccinated, right? So what happened is she, instead of going to work and coming home and going to work and coming home like she normally did, she took a trip to Atlanta. She had some family there. And she got sick, like, the first week in Atlanta. She got, like, just for traveling. I don't know. I guess it was by plane. And I don't think she knew she was sick till she came home. Again, a fully vaccinated person. Medical professional. So, yeah, she said, you know, it was horrible. The thing that struck her the most was the lack of energy. You know, just the overall lack. She didn't necessarily think that was a possible thing. And I said, yeah. Yeah, I go through that all the time with meds, because all my meds are sedatives. All of them are sedatives. You couldn't deal with me without the meds. Medicated for your safety. So she's back, and, you know, but she was just shocked. She was shocked at how little energy it was possible for her to have. She could basically lift her head and drink and make it into the bathroom. That was it. That's all she did for like a week, 10 days. But I was glad to have her back, because, like I said, I have a very good relationship with her, and I didn't want to wind up getting somebody else in the interim, and it just, nah. So I waited. So I saw her on Thursday. I went in on Wednesday, and I got to spend some time with her, just going over meds and stuff. I'm moving from Ambien to something else, because Ambien's not cutting it anymore. The only way I've been getting to sleep is popping Benadryl, and that's probably not the best thing to do. So I forget what it is that they moved me to. Insurance company's balking at it already, but should be ready by sometime this week. Before, this is actually kind of funny, before I had the appointment with her, I had the appointment with my counselor, you know, and this is the new guy. So, you know, we're focusing on now, you know, for the most part. But I happened to be early. I was like super early. So he's like, well, the patient before you canceled, so do you want to take the session now? And I was like, sure, why not? I'm agreeable. So we go into the office, they keep moving him. You know, he's a new guy, so he doesn't have his own office. What are you, crazy? He's not even allowed to touch stuff on the desk, you know? I asked him for his paperwork, what was it, the last session? And he, you know, paperwork meaning his credentials. And he actually pulled out a little card that said that he was basically licensed to do what he does. So I was like, wow, they actually issue cards. I was kidding. I was joking when I asked to see your papers. It's going to become funnier in a moment. So I was in on Wednesday, and we start talking, and I figure, you know, this guy's new. You know, let me throw some of the hard stuff at him. You know, if it can survive the deluge, then I know that we're going to be going forward together for a while, you know? So we start talking, and, you know, I mentioned, you know, I like to get things out there in the open because and this is true. I've had problems with counselors before who have taken offense at some of my beliefs. I guess that would be the word, yeah. And so I thought, you know, so I go, you know, I used to think I was anti-Semitic, but I come to understand that I'm probably more anti-Zionist at heart, really, quite honestly. Just a little dash of anti-Semitism, you know, just enough to kind of, like a little flavor of life, you know. So we start talking and, you know, about it and a little bit, and he's like ripping stuff off. He's like, oh my God, it's like talking to the Connecticut Bureau in reverse. I'm like, holy smokes. What's going on? So I'm listening and I'm listening and I'm going and I'm talking. I'm throwing a little something in there just to kind of keep it moving, you know. We start talking about, you know, World War One and then World War One, World War Two, and then da 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 da. And we're going, we're talking. And all of a sudden, I mean, I'm in there like, you know, we're talking like 15, 20 minutes, right? And I don't really get to talk to people that often, you know. I have people I can call on the phone, and I have an ongoing dialogue, of course. But, I mean, I don't get to talk to, like, you know, people in the wild, as they say, you know, out there in the wild. So I'm talking, and we're talking, and there's something. It's not just your normal liberalism that I'm hearing. You know what I mean? There's something beyond that. It's got something, a little bubble, like, you know, like seltzer, or more accurately, like celery soda. As it turns out, I look up Denny Eye from across the desk, and I go, are you Jewish? And he goes, yes. Oh, my God. I cannot remember the last time I spoke to a Jew. I mean, Rhode Island's a small place, you know. So it's, you know, it's like the reverse of New York in that regard, you know, where you can't go 15 minutes without talking to a Jew. In Rhode Island, it's not that. They're all in, like, one nice little section of Providence called the East Side. And of course, you know, the trains run on time there, the garbage is picked up, the housing is nice. It's basically the opposite of where I live, total opposite. So I'm talking, and I'm like, I'm still trying to get over the fact that the guy is Jewish, you know. I'm like, holy smokes, you know. And then we start talking, you know, again about the camps a little bit, you know. And he said to me, did you know that the last camp that the Americans, or that they wouldn't even, they didn't even, the camp with the homosexuals. So I was like, I'm thinking to myself now, okay, I got set up last time, and I went 15, 20 minutes, right? So I go, so are you a homosexual? And he goes, no. And I go, oh, interesting. But it was quite a moment for both of us, you know. And now I kind of felt bad from the standpoint of that. Like I said, I told him I'm not into rounding people up. I mean, I'm pretty clear about that. Like I said, I think my feeling towards, and again, it's not as if I'm not uneducated, you know. I'm a reasonably intelligent guy. I read a few books back in the day, you know. I grew up with a family that was Jewish, you know. It's not like I'm ignorant or anything, you know. But I kind of, you know, I said to myself, you know, damn, I kind of like this guy. Until we started talking about it, and I still do. And my concern was, check this out, my concern was whether it would be a problem for him going forward. You know, when I asked him, I said, are we okay? Are we good before I left the office? And he goes, yeah, no problem. We went out. We made another appointment. I always shake his hand on the way out. But I think what I'm going to do, just to throw him a bone, is I think when I come in on, I guess I'm not supposed to go into the first, I guess that's February. I'm going to ask him, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, like, how much of an asshole did I actually come across as? Because I am kind of curious. You know, as I said, when you talk and you preach to the choir on a regular, you kind of lose touch with, like, the outside world. And as far as, you know, my anti-Semitism or my anti My mind just blanked for a minute there. Anti-Zionist attitude. And he did admit that Israel does have a lot of sway in the world for a tiny little country. You know, and then we talked a little bit. This is kind of interesting. I was going to end it, but we talked a little bit about the 6 million, you know, and I told him I'm not a Holocaust denier. You know, the intent was there. I mean, if they killed 3 Jews, the intent was there. So, I mean, I don't think there's any arguing that, but I do take issue with the number of the 6 million. And I think that number of 6 million was pulled out of whole cloth. How many exactly? I don't know. I couldn't tell you. 250,000, 750,000, 1 million, 2 million. I don't know. I don't know. I know they killed a lot of other people as well, of course. So, you know, if Israel was looking to pad out those numbers, and my understanding is those numbers came from the Soviets. And you know you can't trust the Soviets. Not even the Russians trust the Soviets now. They finally figured it out. Even some of that stuff that's going on there, I feel so bad. For the Russian people, this is a side note. I haven't done a side note in like years. This is a side note. You know, it's interesting as countries. I'm a big fan of nationalism, whether it be Americans being exhibiting nationalism in regards to being Americans and Russians committing the nationalism in regards to whatever makes them Russian, defines them as a state, you know. Same thing with the Germans and the English. I think nationalism and national pride is a very important thing. I think, again, when everybody's attitude, every single country's attitude should be my country first. And that's what they should be negotiating about. And that's what they should be arguing about. And that's what all, yeah. But unfortunately, the Russians, they got like this big 60-year hole, man. I mean, it's just friggin' ginormous. And I feel bad for them because, like I said, you know, the Soviets, not so good, you know. Just saying. I mean, you think about it. I even said when I was talking to my counselor, I said, you know, Stalin killed more people than Hitler could ever dream of killing. And we both agreed upon that. I didn't ask his background. I mean, they for the most part, they don't want to disclose things of a personal nature, being counselors and whatnot. But I have a way of having people kind of want to engage in the conversation. And they kind of forget to a certain degree. You know, I'm a fun person to talk to, and I like fun people to talk to myself. And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the conversation a great deal. So we're going to see when I go back in there. But, man, I feel bad for those Russians. I was, you know, and again, it's really interesting. I think in terms of the Russians, even I'm watching, and this broke big today, in the aspect of I find things fascinating in regards to Queen Victoria and her offspring. We're watching The Crown. Now, I tried to watch The Crown before. That's the documentary, the docudrama. I think it's a docudrama. That's docudrama that Netflix had on quite some time ago. I don't know how old it is. I don't know if they're adding to it, you know. So we've been watching that because I ran out of the porn. I sent that to my shrink and she's like, but I did say history. See, now I do because of my mispronunciation. What I do now is I say the History Channel show, you know, so right away we're already in the right. You're already, oh yeah. Okay. P-A-W-N, not P-O-R-N. You know, because that could get you in trouble in polite conversation. Not for nothing. Yeah. Yeah. A little too much information. But we've been watching it because I ran out of those to watch. And I don't know when the next one's coming back. So the producer says, because I tried. See, that's the thing. I find a lot of British stuff to be very dry. Very dry. And I tried. I remember years and years and years ago because I think the show's been on a while now. On Netflix, and I was like, oh my god, this is just, it just becomes painful for me, okay? Painful. We tried, and we're in like, I don't know, they switched actresses. It's the older queen already, so it's like maybe season 3, maybe halfway through season 3. And they start to talk about, and it had been mentioned earlier about Philip's mother, the first lady of England, the first man of England, I guess, about his mother and having schizophrenia and being diagnosed by Freud and all that. And we're at the point where she comes back. She was in Greece, and she had like founded a Orthodox, Christian Orthodox, I guess, Greek Orthodox, thing. Well, not a convent, but like a mission, whatever. She was there for a long, 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 long time. Her name was Alice. And they pulled her back. Greece wound up falling again, and she wound up coming back to Buckingham Palace. This is like 1967. And just in time, because the BBC had tried to do an open piece on the life of the royals. And what they wound up doing was kind of portraying the royals as like normal people in, you know, in regards to their day to day. And that's not how it is. They don't sit in the backyard and barbecue. And that was one of the depictions. So one of the younger writers at the, you got to remember, the BBC is huge. And at that time, it was just the BBC pretty much and the offshore stuff. Things like Sky and whatchamacallit were very, very, very far in the future. So the BBC pretty much had the lockdown on everything. So they did this piece. And then one of their writers, I guess a young, like, I don't know if liberal is the word, because these things mean different things in Europe. But he basically tore the piece apart. He tore the special that they had done on the royals apart, just totally ripped it apart. So he was invited back because I think Philip wanted his daughter Anne, Elizabeth's daughter Anne, to try and do an interview that was a little bit more like normal, because Anne was probably the most normal of the bunch of them, quite frankly, being the youngest as well, too. I think there was another brother after her. But anyway, so what she does is what she kind of puts the reporter that was supposed to do the interview with her in the same room as Alice. Again, this would be Philip's mom. And they start, you know, and she's deaf. She was actually deaf since birth, which is totally fascinating. And she read lips and whatnot, so she can read lips. So it was really interesting, and they walked away with an interview that really kind of really balanced things out. You know, it was a very popular. She was very well thought of because of all the volunteer work that she had done. She had gone through all sorts of treatment for her schizophrenia, electrodes, and she had at one point in time, as is prone to some. She had started to have visions, and she said she could talk to Jesus and the Buddha, of all people, the Buddha. So what they wound up doing is Freud friggin' diagnosed her and said that she was oversexed is what it was. So what they did was they actually shot x-rays into her ovaries to kind of get her libido to drop. I mean, all sorts of horrible, horrible things were done to this woman, and she was still a servant of God. And it was really kind of fascinating. And we're watching this, and I'm like thinking, and like, you know, this is kind of like, wow. So I'm like, at one point, it's mentioned that she's related to the Romanovs. So I stopped it where it was. I paused it, and I started to go through Wikipedia. And it's really interesting. She had based her life or modeled her life on the, her aunt, because everything kind of runs through Victoria, and her aunt was Elizabeth, whose husband was assassinated in Russia, and who had gone to the convent and done all sorts of work with the convent and all sorts of medical stuff. That sounds really bright, but you get what I'm saying. I mean, she really, and that was basically during that period of like World War One. So there was a lot of, you know, you had all of the Romanov daughters at one point in time volunteering in hospitals and whatnot. But Elizabeth made that was her life. She committed her life to it. And it turns out that her aunt, it was referred to as her aunt. So you got to remember, Elizabeth married into the Romanov family. Her husband was a Romanov. But I sat there and I'm like, you know, because I've done a fair amount of reading on the Romanovs over the years, obviously. But that and the Templars are probably my two. When I do read a book, that's most likely what I'm reading. But I had no, you know, again, I had no understanding, because there's got to be, and I know there's got to be something on the internet, you know, there's got to be some sort of family tree, like I said, that kind of runs to Victoria, because that would be Queen Victoria. And, you know, I'd just like to see how it kind of like wraps around back in the other direction. Do you know? At one point in time, I believe all the houses of Europe were related to each other, or at least closely, if not by blood, then by marriage. Even during times of war, which, you know, obviously made it really kind of interesting, you know, very much like the American Civil War, where you had families kind of broken up fighting for the North or the South. It just blew my mind. You know, the producer and I were sitting there, and I was reading it off to her as we were going. I'm like, wow, the woman had such an, and now I'm switching back to Alice, such an incredible life, and just so woven into the history of European history for that time. Totally, totally amazing. So she came back in 67 to Buckingham Palace, where she was born, by the way. And she passed. She passed in Buckingham Palace, and I believe her remains were later moved to one of the convents on the Mount of Olives, as a matter of fact. I believe Elizabeth was murdered with the rest of the Romanovs, so she didn't get a chance to get out. You know, the more and more I talk to people about that, people are like, you know, when you do start to talking about stuff like that, they're still really amazed that no one came to their aid, that they wouldn't allow them into England. And there was a window of opportunity before the Bolsheviks arrived, because it was the Bolsheviks that murdered them. But prior to that, it was just a civil war, red and white. It blows people's minds. I mean, it really blows. If you look at other offspring, hell, if you look at the King of England and you look at the Tsar of Russia, they were practically almost indistinguishable. And again, there's that family wraparound thing, you know. Quite amazing, quite amazing. But particularly, I like when I can see something that's kind of related to it, and it pushes it all the way into, you know, she passed in 1969. So this is like, what, 50 years, more than 50 years? She decided to model her life on a woman who lived and died in Tsarist Russia. Blows your mind. So we're watching that, and we're just getting past. I'm upset that they totally missed the Beatles. They didn't. I'm like that guy. It's like, what do you mean? They didn't do anything on the Beatles. They just kind of skipped over it. Next thing you know, we're in 65 and Churchill dies, which was actually very sad. I've always meant to start reading a biography on Churchill, but there are so many of them. Literally so many of them that I would have to have, I guess I'll go on the internet, you know, that internet thing, and see if I can find something that I don't know. Nothing is universally agreed upon, but that's the thought of highly, I guess, would be what I would want to do. So we're watching smart stuff. We may be watching television, but we're watching, it's shifted gear into smart stuff. And we've started to separate a little bit more. You know, I'm starting to spend a little time on my own in the bedroom, and she's starting to spend a little bit more time in the office doing whatever she needs to do. And it's still, we're just still dealing, you know. I had a very good conversation with my Aunt Margaret, who is Jerry's older sister, who has stepped in, and we're doing the whole holding down the fort until the house can be sold situation. And the majority of times I've spoken to her, it's been business-related, you know, in the sense of, oh, did you get this in the mail yet, or I need to do that, or did you do this, you know, that sort of stuff, you know. So she called, she woke me up I guess it was 5 o'clock or so the other day. And I didn't tell her she woke me up, cause it was five, you know. She knows not to call early cause I'm generally sleeping, but she knows, I didn't want to let her know that, excuse me, I'm drinking soda again, by the way, I fell off the wagon. I don't want to talk about it anymore. Okay. I'm just being honest. But no, I thought it was something that she needed to have done, or, you know, and she's like, no, I just want to call, see how you were. So I was like, oh, okay, I can do that. So we did. So yeah, she's, so we talked for about an hour, you know, about a lot of things, a little bit of the past, a little bit of the present, a little bit of the future. I mean, I always had a decent relationship with Margaret. She's the oldest sister. So it was Jerry, my mother, and then Margaret. And Margaret usually lived out of state. So there wasn't always a lot of seeing her and her kids. And I didn't even know her youngest daughter, Katie, who I think highly of, Jerry's favorite, who I think highly of. You know, she and I have been spending a lot of time together, whether it be on the phone or, you know, they came down here. And they're planning on coming back. I feel a sense of connection to my family. There's less of them. This is true. But I feel a sense of connection, and I never really had that before because it wasn't something that it really existed for me, you know. It's easier to remember the bad stuff. It's not always easy to remember the good stuff. So, that being said, I'm very pleased. And things are, they're moving along. Like I said, we're going to be here till like September at least, so... You know, we're just kind of figuring things out. There's really no other way to put it. That's really what we're doing, is we're figuring things out. I was finally, I had Jerry's urn downstairs with her remains, or one third of her remains, downstairs. And when the house was going to be cleaned out, one of the things that they give you, this little pre-pamphlet thing, things that you should kind of know and or be prepared for, you know. And one of them was remove urns or remains in them, because you wouldn't want to get them thrown out by accident. And that was true. I wouldn't. So I took them from, they were on the top of a bookcase downstairs, and I moved them into the bedroom, on the bedroom floor in front of my main dresser. And they've been in there for a couple of few weeks, and I didn't really. And then we found half, because the producer wrote the obit, or contributed heavily towards her obit. And we had that handwritten piece of paper that she had done in the same box, you know, because it was still in the box. I just left it. I just couldn't move it. You know, it was just kind of like, it weighed like a million pounds or something. You know, it's just not something that I was capable of doing at that moment. This week I was able to move them. They're on a dresser, in the hallway. It's a pretty big house, by the way. In the hallway, still in their box, but, you know, I was able to physically touch them. I looked at the urn, I pulled the urn out and looked at it, and it's nice. It's got her name, and it says, you know, beloved sister and aunt, and in the center of it, it's got a fleur-de-lis, you know, because my aunt was ginormous on the fleur-de-lis, being, you know, being of French descent. I don't care to mention her last name, but of French descent, so... So that's some progress, at least. Sad thing is her cat, the feral one who no one can touch. Or when you walk by in the hallway, there's what's called the sitting room. And that was the room into, well, the sitting room to Jerry's bedroom. And then there's like one step down. And when you walk by now, and if the light's on, you can see the cat's head poke up out of the, on top of the stairs. And she's like, you know, obviously waiting for Jerry to come back. Even though, like I said, the cat is feral. I'm kid you not. Jerry could barely even touch this cat. But I guess she had spent enough time with Jerry where it's like, where's my person? You know, where's my human? And it's hard. You can't comfort the cat because the cat won't come near you. So, but luckily my cat, it's Batsy, and her and she, Chauncey is her name. They have, they're like best buddies. So, every now and then you'll walk by and you'll see the two of them sitting on the heating vent together, laying intertwined on the heating vent, you know? So, you know, at least there's some comfort for the cat. I don't know, you know, and then in the long term, I don't know if I can take this cat with me. So that's a whole other, you know, if I agonize, and I probably have mentioned this because I know I mentioned it to my counselor and whatnot. That's going forward. That's one of the things that I don't know how it's going to play out. I have no idea how it's going to play out. I don't know what my options are. I know I'm going to get some help from Katie and whatnot, and we're going to try and figure out what to do about the cat, if we can get it to a no-kill shelter, which means she'll probably just be a lifelong resident, because, you know, you can't get near her. But then again, perhaps with a little bit more intensive, you know, human contact, she'll come around. It's been known to happen. So I'm kind of hoping that's the case. But well, we'll have to wind up saying, let me take a sip of this here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm drinking this Mountain Dew Code Red, the cherry stuff. Oh, God, I love it. Yeah, I know. It's going to be like I'm going to wind up going into some sort of diabetic coma and dying. Just when things kind of start to get better, it'll be like, and that's it. Midwood's gone. But screaming and kicking. Screaming and kicking. I have a will to live. I do. I have a will to live. I'm trying to think if there's anything else this week on the personal side of stuff. Not really. Really been, you know, like I said, kind of quiet. Yeah, let me do some news. I got a little bit of news here. Actually, I got more than a little bit. You know, what is the deal with Biden? These fucking documents, man. You know, it kind of reminds me, you know, this is really funny. I was thinking about this with Biden and how there were documents, and then, there were more documents, you know. And then I think now there's even more documents, right? But I remember when I was, like, 12 years old, you know, I had, you know, normal. I was living in Brooklyn. I was living on 388 Avenue X. I was living between East 1st and East 2nd, right? And I had a lot of friends on East 2nd Street, right? And, you know, everybody had parents who were, like, home. There was, like, a stay-home mom. And I was the only guy who had keys to my apartment at, like, 12, 13 years old. I was what they call a latchkey kid. Yeah. And so one day we all decide that we're going to go up to my place and play spin the bottle, which, I don't know, there were, like, six of us. There was three guys, three girls, you know. We don't know nothing about nothing, quite frankly, but we're curious, right? So my father had this, it was a bar. It was a cabinet with two drawers, and then there were like compartments on the side, and there was booze, you know. And so we took one of the bottles out, right? And, you know, and we're playing it 15, 20 minutes. Now, my father, he never got home before 6 o'clock. I mean, it's just, you know, and it was like clockwork, you know, because he got out, he worked in the Diamond District in Manhattan, and he got out, and he got on a certain train, and that was the F train, and he would take the F train all the way to Avenue X over there on McDonald Avenue, I don't know what it's called now, and he would walk up, and I had it pretty well timed out. So we're spinning, it's got to be like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, right after school, you know. And then there's a click, click at the door. And I look, and it's my dad. And he tells everybody to get out. And he beats the snot out of me. Okay. All right. You know. Right. So, the next fucking day, we do the same thing. I said, it's astronomical. Because I want to look cool in front of my friends, you know. There's no way. We're sitting there at 4 o'clock. Click, click. Oh, God. Get out. Winds up beating the snot out of me again, you know? So, you know, I'm thinking and I'm saying to myself, what is the deal with Biden? How many times is he going to get the snot beat out of him before he starts leaving his stuff lying around? How long? It's incredible. You know, and of course, we know what they did to President Trump. Right. But apparently, and this is really a big surprise, there's a double standard. I would have never have guessed that there was a double standard. I'm not hearing that rattling tonight. I took that low filter off on my S286, if anybody's interested. And I'm not really hearing that rattle that I normally hear. So it might have been a low filter, low cut filter. Wait. All right. Let me see. I know I got some news in here. I pulled a bunch of stuff, actually. All right. What's that? This is the Daily Mail. Biden classified files were sent to another D.C. location before they were stored at a think tank. So they're apparently what they're saying here is that it went somewhere where it shouldn't have been, and then it went to another place where it shouldn't have been, which is real. And this is the first batch. Let me see. The long and I'm going to read this. little drink. Yeah, and in case you're wondering, my dad used to beat the snot out of me a lot. So, I just had this little voice in my head. You might want to mention that. Just to preface it. But anyway, we'll put it on the post log. Everything will be fine. P.S. Postscript. The long and winding presidential, the long and winding document trail that leads to classified documents from Joe Biden's vice presidential office to the Joe Biden's vice presidential office. Wait a minute. I'm not even sure that makes sense. Okay, well, office to the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement in Washington, D.C., and now back into the hands of the government, includes yet another stopover, a temporary facility in the nation's capital, a source tells the Daily Mail. The documents were moved in the summer of 2017 after spending about 6 months at a government transition office near the White House once Biden left the presidency. Okay. The space in D.C.'s Chinatown neighborhood, overseen by the Penn Biden Center, is a prized location near the Capitol, was being readied. The office had its formal opening attended by Biden in 2018. Interesting. The new location adds yet another layer to the confusing classified documents debacle in which the files ended up locked inside a cabinet at the Biden Penn Center, where they got discovered in November 2022, while raising new questions about the total universe of people who might have access to the documents over the last 6 years. Good question. People involved in the process include Biden's former staff members, General Services Administration personnel, and the staff at the think tank, an entity that would later have roles for senior aides in the remaining in Biden's orbit, including now Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who served as the center's managing director. The woman who oversaw the packing and shipping of Biden's documents in 2017 was former administrative assistant Kathy Chung, who secured the position with a well-placed recommendation from Hunter Biden, who touted her capabilities to his father. Isn't that great? Hunter Biden recommended it. Wow. Let me think about that for a second. What's this, a phrase? Hunter Biden recommended it. Okay. So, they had worked together at the Department of Commerce years ago, the person said. Hunter notified her of the opportunity, asked if she was interested, and found that she was. He spoke to her father about her, said the person, and so did former Delaware Senator Ted Kaufman, a longtime Biden associate who is among the trio of Democratic senators she has worked for in the past. Hunter Biden did a stint at the agency under Secretary William Daley at the tail end of the Clinton administration from 1998 to 2001, following a job at the bank at the start of a career in law and lobbying. Then, as now, he had his father's ear on a variety of matters. Wow. Chung was the first person to be publicly identified as meeting with federal investigations in the matter. She spoke to U.S. Attorney John Walsh's office. His office, before Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed the special counsel Robert Hur to oversee the document probe. Officials working with Biden at the time who remain attached to him are senior aides Steve Ricchetti and Catherine Bedingfield. Yeah, that's it, Bedingfield. And senior advisor Mike Donilian. These names. The former assistant, I should just be able to block, you know, just like refer to people as, anyway, I mean, the former assistant helped oversee the packing of files, the busy tail end of Biden's second term as VP. That was the time that featured a flurry of activity by Biden himself, even in the final days in office. It is required keeping his office function even while things were being put away for safekeeping. There is no indication that Chung knew the boxes of documents also included documents marked classified that Biden lawyer Patrick Moore discovered while cleaning out Biden's former D.C. office in November. Okay, so what we're saying here is that Chung didn't necessarily know that they were classified. She helped pack up the contents of the vice president's office, including documents, and was responsible for their being transferred to the transition office, said the person, who said Chung had responsibility for the move. She just didn't know the context of every box that was being moved. Okay, that's reasonable, I guess. Mixed up with what had been reported to be 10 government documents, some marked top secret, were the contents of desks and cabinets from Biden's old office. Papers related to late son Beau Biden's funeral, and a document related to home repairs at the Biden's Wilmington house, a site that itself was revealed to contain additional classified material. The GSA had previously confirmed that Biden's team that vacated their transition office in July 2017, which is when the documents began their next leg of their journey, heading southeast across the city. The Penn Biden Center did not respond to a request for comment about exactly how long the boxes of material remained at the Chinatown location and who accessed it. Hang on. Okay. Here we go. The discovery of the documents has presented an immediate political problem for Biden, who said Thursday he had no regrets about the situation and scolded reporters for asking him about it while he was touring devastation in California. There is no there, he said. In addition to special counsel, House GOP investigators have already begun sending out requests for information. Hunter Biden's role had previously been identified in emails found on his infamous laptop. Thanks for calling and thinking of me, Chung wrote to Hunter on May 2012, according to Fox News, after getting put forward for the job when predecessor Michelle Smith was leaving. After the initial shock of taking in what you said, how could I pass up on an opportunity to work for the Vice President of the United States? As DailyMail.com reported this week, a newly surfaced photo from the laptop appears to show the president's sons driving a classic Corvette Stingray outside the same Wilmington home where the car and documents marked classified were being stored. At the White House Friday, the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre again stressed that Biden and his team were cooperating with investigators after alerting the National Archives following the discovery of classified material. She once again declined further comment, even to specify what Biden was referring to when he had no regrets, referring to matters from the Justice Department. Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people took offense to the fact that he said he had no regrets. You know, you make a mistake. Mistakes were made, you know. Files were moved. Things happened. But he doesn't have any regrets. Oh, well. That speaks to the kind of people we're dealing with here. Like I said, and meanwhile, the double standard, Gonna derail my program. Let's see. What else do I have? Alec Baldwin. Alec Baldwin will be charged with 2 counts of involuntary manslaughter in Rush shooting. All right. Now, I've given this one a lot of thought. And I really don't like Alec Baldwin. Outside of like Beetlejuice and Hunt for Red October, and I could easily give up those 2 movies if I had to for the rest of my life. Now, that being said, anything bad that happens to Alec Baldwin is okay in my book. Perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. I have no problem with the universe dumping on him. None whatsoever at all. However, in this particular case, the mechanics of said delivery of dumping on Alec Baldwin are a little, you know, I can't expect an actor, someone who plays make-believe, all actors do that, that's their job, that's what they do for a living. I can't expect them to be handling firearms that may or may not necessarily have ammunition in them. I don't think that that falls on Baldwin. I think that falls on, what's the other dude's name? What's the other dude's name? Oh, let me read it. Alec Baldwin, well, this is out of Yahoo News. Huh? Imagine that. Alec Baldwin will be charged with 2 counts of involuntary manslaughter for the death of Halyna Hutchins. New Mexico prosecutors have been weighing as to whether to bring criminal charges for months. Halyna, a rising cinematographer, was killed on the set of Rust when a gun Baldwin was holding discharged during rehearsals. He repeatedly maintained he did not pull the trigger. The 30 rock star is just one of 3 people authorities believe played a role in Halyna's death. He must have pulled the trigger, otherwise it wouldn't have gone off. That's it. So he's lying there. I mean, if you want to get him on some sort of lying, some sort of perjury or something, then be my guest. This decision distorts Halyna Hutchinson's tragic death and represents a terrible miscarriage of justice. Mr. Baldwin had no reason to believe there was a live bullet in the gun or anywhere on the movie set. The actor's attorney, Luke Nikas of Quinn Emanuel, tells Yahoo Entertainment he relied on professionals with whom he worked who assured him the gun did not have live rounds. We will fight these charges and we will win. I suspect they may. I also, what was the armor? I guess, is it armor? Is that what they're referring to as? I'm not quite sure. I think it might be. Most likely, I would think. What's the other dude's name? I'm just scanning now and I can't find stuff. Well, you never find stuff when you're scanning. Alec Baldwin, Hanneke Cherris Reed, or David Hall. So I had done their job. See, that's right. I mean, my point is that we've seen actors killed with blanks in the gun. Brendan Lee, remember The Crow? He actually died before The Crow was finished production. I don't think his old man died in a similar circumstance, but there was another big one. Where it was, again, a case of the weapon was had blanks in it, but it was held too close to the person's head and therefore caused death or injury. I know it was another actor. I can't remember who it was. But, no, I don't think the actors, these are props. And, you know, when you're spending millions and millions and millions of dollars on a movie, I would expect that the prop people would be on their shit. It's as simple as that. So there's no way in the, you know, he should not have been handed a gun unless it was safety checked. That's the end of the story. So as much as I hate Alec Baldwin, I don't know if this falls on him. You know, it's interesting. Hollywood, there's always all these Hollywood people, you know, they're always about, oh, telling us what we can do, you know, and deciding guns are bad and everybody should get along and like each other. But, you know, they're in these movies that portray and glorify the use of guns. And in this particular case, and, it wound up killing someone, which is obviously tragically sad. And New Mexico, man, you know, I think they know about guns in New Mexico, not for nothing. So you hold the armorer responsible. I mean, if it, like I said, the sticking point to me would be he said he didn't pull the trigger. So he's denying any culpability whatsoever at all, even just taking the long way home. He's just totally saying, I didn't pull the trigger. Well, someone pulled the trigger because the gun discharged. Simple as that. Guns don't discharge unless you pull the trigger. Not historically speaking. Well, maybe that's not entirely true about some models of revolver in the early days. You know, they used to, what they used to do is they used to load 5 rounds in these single action revolvers when it was a 6-round, you know, 6-round chambers. It was chambered for 6 round. The spinny roundy thing. I can't believe I can't think of this right now. But anyway, they would put the hammer down on the empty chamber so that there wouldn't be any cylinder is what it's called. On an empty chamber in the cylinder so that just in case there was any banging or anything happened, the gun wouldn't go off accidentally. Because apparently they did used to do that. There was a, you know, that could possibly happen, but the weapon would have to be banged around. I mean, it's not like simply holding it and not pulling the trigger would not be enough to discharge the weapon. So Baldwin's lying. He's lying. And I think he's going to get caught lying. And if they get him for that alone, some sort of perjury, whatever, then fine. And it's still involuntary, meaning he obviously did not show up on the movie set with the intent of shooting anybody. I'm sure quite possibly one of, if not the worst day in the man's life. But still, you know, I just wish it could have been something more solid, you know, that they could have gotten him on something more and more solid. Something like this is, you know, it's going to change the way things work. You know, if he is actually convicted, it'll change the way things work, most likely for the better. And I say again, you know, I'm the kind of guy, like when I'm watching, and this used to happen like a lot on the old sitcoms, and I've seen it on some not so great movies where, you know, you'll see a mic in the frame, you'll see an overhead mic in the frame, or you'll see the shadow of the mic because the light's coming from multiple directions. You can ask the producer about it. It's a pet peeve of mine. It really annoys me when there's, again, these multi-million, they have like their fucking food thing is like $500,000. Their food budget, like sitting there on the tray on the thing where they can go get the donuts and the coffee, you know? $500,000. The motherfuckers can't be bright enough to keep the goddamn mic out of the frame? Oh, that's one of my bigger pet peeves. I have a list. But that's one of the bigger ones. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. And interesting enough, I do have another, what's the second one? I can't find, Mickey Rourke. Okay, this was actually Mickey. I'm a big Mickey Rourke fan from back in the day. Pulp of Greenwich Village, I mean, really. Mickey Rourke, and this was on Fox, Mickey Rourke declares no way in hell Alec Baldwin should be charged in fatal Rust shooting. Here we go. Alec Baldwin faces involuntary manslaughter and the death of his cinematographer, Helena Hutchins, on the set of the movie Rust. Okay. Mickey Rourke vehemently defended Alec Baldwin after the departed star was charged with involuntary manslaughter in the 2021 death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins. The 70-year-old actor took to Instagram on Friday to share his thoughts after New Mexico prosecutors announced that Baldwin, 64, would face a criminal charge on Thursday. Hutchinson, 42, was killed by a live round from a gun that Baldwin was holding while rehearsing for a scene for the Reston movie Rust. I usually never put my 2 cents in about what happens on someone's movie set. The Academy Award nominee began the lengthy caption for his post, which featured a photo of Baldwin. He continued, "It's a terrible tragedy what happened to cinematographer Helena Hutchins, but no way in hell actor Alec Baldwin should be charged with any negligence whatsoever. Most actors don't know anything about guns, especially if they don't grow up around them. Alec didn't bring the gun to the set from his house or his car when weapons are involved in a movie set. The guns are supposed to be handled only by the weapons armorer." The wrestling star went on to explain, in some cases, the first AD may pass a gun to the actor, but most of the time the gun is handed to the actor directly by the gun armorer. That's the armorer's job on the set, to have the expert around any type of dangerous weapons. the actor then has the option of dry firing the gun, him or herself, to double check. No way in hell should Alec Baldwin have been blamed for the unfortunate tragedy, while the powers that to be charging Baldwin with his responsibility is terribly wrong. I'm sure Alec is already suffering over enough of what happened, but to lay the blame on him is terribly, terrible wrong. It's a terribly, terrible wrong. That's okay. The former professional boxer concluded his post by saying, "With my deepest condolences to Elena Hutchinson, to her family, and to her friends." Rust armorer Hannah Gutierrez-Reed is also facing charges of involuntary manslaughter. The movie's assistant director, David Halls, was charged with negligent use of a deadly weapon and chose to plead guilty in agreement with the district attorney's office. He will be given a suspended sentence and 6 months of probation. Halls allegedly handled Baldwin a .45 caliber revolver, telling him it was cold or safe. Prior to that, Gutierrez spun the cylinder to show Halls what was in the gun, her lawyer said. Baldwin has maintained that he did not pull the trigger of the gun once during a primetime interview shortly following the deadly shooting, and again on a podcast episode. The actor originally said he had pulled the hammer of the gun back as far as he could and released it, but did not pull the trigger. After the charges were announced, Baldwin's attorney called it a terrible miscarriage of justice and argued that his client relied on professionals with whom he had worked to ensure that the set was safe. This decision distorts Hannah Henderson's tragic death and represents a terrible miscarriage of justice. Luke Nikas of Quinn Emanuel said Thursday in a statement to Fox Digital. Okay, so this is repetition after this part. I would generally tend to agree. I'm running out of gas, and I think I'm gonna wind up pulling the trigger here. Pardon the pun. and hit the road. I'm trying to get my endurance back up to be able to do more than an hour. I don't ever want to do more than two anymore, ever again. I think 90 is a sweet spot, but I have to kind of work myself up to some endurance, a little bit of dry runs, if you will, before that. But there's a little Mountain Dew burp. But there will come a point in time in the not so distant future where I'm doing another 30 at least. That being said, I'm going to direct you over to lfmidwood.com. Let me get rid of that. Okay, and let me pull this up. Head over to lfmidwood.com. You'll find my latest archives, most likely the one you're hearing. you'll find links up on top. 11LRNI take you over to John Lightning's page, and all the way over to the right is our good friend Brad Reed over at Gretz Radio. Give his stream a listen. Quality product on there. Take my word for it. That being said, like I said, you can find archives. Some of my social media is available under Take the Red Pill, and under that you'll find favorites, and you'll find some more of my favorite social media available, and some of the links that I use to actually compose the program. Yeah, I guess compose is the word, right? Anyway, that being said, I thank you for imbibing, and what I'm going to do is, let me see, make sure I got this queued up, because I screw this part up. Okay, let me pull this up, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to close out with some David Bowie again. Opened with Bowie, closed with Bowie, Modern Love. Thank you for imbibing, and stay golden, Pony Boy.
I know when to go out. I know when to stay in. Get things done. Bye.
You've been listening to the Midwood Files on Radio New York International. Thanks for listening.